Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 22nd of September. Two journalists who have, at times, held destiny in their hands.
Aha. Well, I mean, to start with,
yes,
we talked about Rupert Murdoch, and you revealed, and I don't want to spoil it, an amazing anecdote story about how you are basically personally responsible for his longevity.
Well, people should listen, but I saved Rupert Murdoch's life.
You need to listen.
I don't know whether that's a boast or something to be ashamed of. But,
I mean, it's essential listening.
Or at least I saved him from a broken nose.
I think at minimum.
What else did we talk about, Matt?
Then we talked about the allegations against Russell Brand and what they meant, and also the era from which they hail, and what, if anything, has changed.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit at the end about Michael Caine's new movie and about Keir Starmer's wrestling with the EU.
Yes.
And both had things to
say
about
that. We have
a
slightly different take on it. But
we do, but that is a feature of what he thinks, isn't it?
It's certainly a feature of Brexit.
It's a feature of, yeah, exactly.
So what are we going to call this week's episode?
Rupert and Russell?
Saving Rupert Murdoch, or...
I saved Murdoch's life.
You
obviously.
Didn't. I did. I saved Murdoch's life. Fair enough. We're going to call
that.
Okay. So this is the Two Matts, episode 14. I saved Rupert Murdoch's life.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, breaking news.
Massive breaking news. We're recording this on Thursday.
We need to give the time to make this absolutely on point at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, and within the last half hour, the news has broken that Rupert Murdoch is stepping down from his position at the pinnacle of the media empire that has been at the heart of politics and media for decades, and handing over to his son Lachlan.
Yeah.
So the succession storyline has been resolved not in four seasons, but in a space of one press release. And it's, I think... For both of us, having been in journalism, you know, for the period we have respectively, it's, and indeed for anyone who's interested in media and politics and power, it's a hell of a moment, isn't it?
I mean, it's literally all our lives.
Yes.
He has been. Our chosen profession is journalism, centred around newspaper journalism.
Yes.
So all our lives, he has literally been the dominant figure in that industry.
Yeah, I mean, my first job in journalism... I'd done a brief stint at Index on censorship as a researcher, but my first sort of full-time job was at The Times from 1991 as a graduate trainee. And I have to say, I had a wonderful time at The Times, 5 years. And, it was still in Wapping. The whole of the news operation was there. And it was a massive plant. And you'd go, the journalists would file in the morning. And then at night... big trucks would come down a ramp full of copies of The Sun and The Times.
Yeah.
Or at the weekends, The News of the World, RIP, and The Sunday.
RIP with a stake in its heart.
Yes, indeed. I mean, RIP in the sort of polite sense of the word, courteous, and The Sunday Times. And it felt like, and it was... the beating heart of something.
Yeah.
And, you know, the extent to which, particularly before, this was pre the web, really, and long pre social media, there were only a few, seven national news titles. Right. So the extent to which, I mean, I did a lot of editorial writing at the Times, and it was the case.
You should explain what that means.
The editorial in the newspaper, and still exists, is the unsigned view of the newspaper. And there's usually a bunch of people who write this on the basis of what the editor of the day has decided is the right policy for the paper. And at the time, and this was a sort of bracing introduction to the world of politics, if you were writing leaders, they were called, leading articles for the Times, you would be put straight through to the relevant cabinet minister on background, who would be wanting to sell the policy of the day. Now, I don't know if that's still true anymore, but it's just a way of giving a sense of how, you know, the Sun was obviously much, much bigger in terms of circulation, and it was massive in Tony Blair's campaign to become Prime Minister in 1997, because the Sun backed him. But the Times was kind of at the heart of, if you like, policy making and the intellectual side of politics. And, you know, Murdoch would come and have little lunches and was unfailingly courteous. And I think we've discussed this on the podcast before. You know, whatever else one says about his impact upon British culture and politics, and there's a lot to say, he loved newspapers.
He did, yeah.
He had and has ink in his blood. Yeah. He really does.
He does. And the, you know, it's worth probably recapping for those who aren't newspaper obsessives, how it all began, really. And he bought a moribund tabloid newspaper called The Sun from, I think, the Thompsons.
Yeah,
they owned it at the time. It had been started by the Mirror Group and had sort of bounced along and not done very much. And the Mirror in the 1950s was the absolute dominant working class newspaper in the world, you know. And the Mirror actually invented that kind of journalism, very picture-based, speaking in the working class vernacular, anti-establishment, you know. So not, you know, that when they blew up royal family secrets and stuff like this, it's hard now to describe.
It was
the kind
massively
of sense
powerful.
Of shock.
Massively powerful.
And a campaigning paper as well, you know. It was a real great newspaper, largely conceived by a genius called Hugh Cudlip, who is memorialised in the Hugh Cudlip Award every year at the Society of Editors Award. And then Murdoch comes along and picks up this lookalike, The Sun, which is a nothing, very modest circulation in comparison to the Mirror, which was selling, I think, about 5 million copies at the time. There was one issue of the Daily Mirror sold 7 million copies in a single day. It was the Queen's coronation issue.
Incredible.
And that, I think today, that is still
it's
a world
still
record. And it'll, of course, never be beaten for an English language newspaper. Murdoch comes along, buys The Sun, and utterly copies the Daily Mirror's secret, but with steroids, on steroids. And
a right-wing.
And a right-wing agenda. And then later, 10, 15 years later, having gone through the editorship of a guy called Larry Lamb, a certain Kelvin McKenzie arrives. And Kelvin McKenzie slots into Murdoch's vision of what The Sun should be.
Perfectly.
Absolutely perfectly.
Yeah.
He's aggressive. He's populist. He's right-wing. He's very sexist. But he has got the ability, like him or loathe him, he has got the ability to catch a story and project it to
and
the nation.
And a headline.
With such gusto
that
it becomes compelling. And this is the secret of the Soar Away Sun.
Yeah.
And that was their catchphrase, the Soar Away Sun. And it went on to dominate media for 25, 30 years, probably.
It was, this is why when Blair won over the Sun, I mean, now it's hard to explain how big a moment that was in the end of that Conservative era.
Yeah, that's
you know,
right.
Because the Sun had been so supportive of Thatcher and then initially supportive of Major, but not after Major's sort of the disaster of Black Wednesday and his decline. And but for the Sun, with all of what you've just described, Matt, to back the Labour Party was a huge cultural and political moment.
As you say, that very famous Kinnock front page where they had Kinnock in a light
bulb
saying,
the last,
please switch off the lights if Kinnock wins.
And Kinnock was furious with our colleague Alistair Campbell, and as he relates in his diaries, and with Blair himself for cozying up to Murdoch, though. In terms of getting Labour back into office, they were dead right.
So again, when we think about Murdoch's influence on culture, and I would hate listeners to think that any of this is hagiographic, because it's not. But there's no way to get around from the fact that Murdoch has been a defining cultural influence.
It's just
on
historical.
This nation.
It's for two generations. It's empirical.
So Murdoch invites Blair to their big conferencing.
Yeah, I was there.
And you were there.
I was there.
What was it like?
Well, it was extraordinary because there are two aspects to it which are extraordinary. First of all, it was amazing to have the whole group of the Murdoch bits of the Empire there, and it was they were just about to launch Fox News.
So like the meeting of the five families.
It was very much like on a sunny island off the coast of Australia. And then to see Blair, Alistair Campbell, Angie Hunter, you know, all wearing suits, I remember, because they were very rightly nervous that someone from the Mirror would be there in the trees taking photographs, and they didn't want to be seen in News Corp leisure wear, which we were all hilariously wearing. Yeah. So there was, I mean, just as an experience, it was amazing. And I remember one of the workshops, one of the Americans said, wouldn't it be better if the Times, which I worked for at the time, was called the Murdoch Times? And I had to explain that this would be, a very, very imaginative idea, probably suboptimal, right? But the other thing that was striking, and it shows how, you know, there is an element of succession in all this, is that Lachlan, who was then quite young, was being introduced at one of the dinners to every single table. And it was absolutely clearly a laying on of hands.
Right.
But as we know, the story was not linear, because Lachlan went out, fell out of favour. The other son, James, came into the picture. Elizabeth, the daughter, sort of was named for a while. And this is where Jesse Armstrong got the idea for Waystar Royko and Logan Roy and Succession and so on. But actually, it's all come back to Lachlan.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is an amazing story.
So I got a little Lachlan anecdote, personal story. I was doing a subbing shift on The Times. This must have been in about 1995. And sat next to me... Well, no, 1992 or so.
That's I was there.
Sat next to me was Lachlan Murdoch doing a subbing shift. Dad had put him in to spend a week on The Sun, a couple of days on The Times, spend time with the commercial department, go out with the distribution guys, spend time with a news agent to, again, steep him in the newspaper culture. And I do remember, obviously, I was on a tryout for a job. Lachlan was sitting there. He had a huge, big, thick textbook of the works of Immanuel Kant on his book. When we went off for a pint from Wapping, he said, "No, I'm just going to stay behind. I'm on chapter 16. I've got to get through it by the end of the week." But I do remember it was the time when Buckingham Palace had just been open to tourists, and there was a headline that Lachlan had been working on. And he had spelt the word Q. It was a terrible headline he'd written, but I was looking over his shoulder, and he'd spelt the word Q, C-U-E, right? And
fabulous.
The chief sub-editor wandered over and looked over his shoulder, and I was sitting there thinking, oh, my God, I can't wait for this.
This is going to be a moment.
And he tapped him on the back, and he said, great headline, son, great headline. And walked
off. There's nothing like professional courage, is there?
So I don't know whether Lachlan yet knows how to spell the word Q, but anyway, he's washed up okay, as it turns out.
We may not find out. And I suppose, should we scroll forward to hacking and
yes,
all that?
Yes, definitely.
Because...
Well, I mean, I on a personal basis, I would like to... also mention Hillsborough as well.
Oh, good point. Yes.
Which I think was the first of a number of massive catastrophic missteps by News UK, but one that never really was taken responsibility for within the Murdoch empire. And I've always wondered, had Murdoch responded to Kelvin McKenzie's atrocious reporting around the Hillsborough disaster, if he'd have responded to it in the same way that he did around the Millie Dowler phone hacking, how different things might have turned out. Because you might have had a period of a chastened Sun newspaper, you know, had that, you know, if the Sun had done the Hillsborough disaster and had been held accountable for it at the time, he'd have closed that down, presumably.
I think to your point, it's all about power, isn't it?
Yeah.
At the time of Hillsborough
yeah.
And reporting on that, the Sun couldn't give a toss.
It That's right.
felt complete impunity. By the time Millie Dowler came round, it was a very different story because it was now competing in the era of social media and everything online and so on.
Yeah.
So I suppose to recap hacking, what happened in a nutshell was that it became clear that and I was hacked, you know, myself.
Were
you? Yeah, not to any extent. I was editing The Spectator, and given my predecessor, Mr. Boris Johnson, I think the ex officio, the editor of The Spectator, was hacked, or just on a sort of industrial level, you know. There were only three calls, but I did have to go into Putney Cop Shop and give a statement. I mean, there was nothing.
Did you get any money from it?
No, I mean, you know, there was nothing. It didn't amount to a row of beans. Right. But it was a massive, massive consequential story. And it the thing that kind of, I think, tipped the balance was the fact that the News of the World was revealed to have hacked the phone of Millie Dowler, who was a very young girl killed. And this then led to the Leveson inquiry. And I don't know if our producer, Matt Hill, has got a clip of Murdoch and James Murdoch appearing before...
It's not Leveson, is it?
It's not Leveson. It's one of the committees. It's the select committee.
Yeah. And it's an extraordinary moment.
It's an incredible moment.
And one that made us all gasp, I think. Have you got it, Matt?
As for my comments, Mr. Chairman, and my statement, which I believe was around the closure of the News of the World newspaper.
Before you get to that, I would just like to say one sentence. This is the most humble day of my life.
I mean, it's... Even now, it's astonishingly...
It's amazing. It was an amazing moment. Watching a person who we'd all seen bestride the world, having to admit that there were limits to his power. I think it was the first time that had ever happened, certainly publicly.
I think it was the first time it had ever occurred to him as
well.
Yes. You know, that it seemed to me to be a guy who was just suddenly caught in a reality moment, a massive reality check.
Yes.
And that's what he was. I don't think he was referring to humility around the harm he'd caused Millie Dowler's family, or the kind of betrayal in journalistic ethics or any of that. I think he was referring to the humility he himself suddenly felt at this sudden whipping away of the carpet from underneath his feet.
I mean, it was like busted, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm busted, and he wasn't used to that.
Yeah.
Because to use your mafia analogy, you know, he thought he'd metaphorically with the political class bought protection from the cops, and here he was suddenly in front of MPs having to answer for stuff, and it was a very disagreeable experience for him.
Yeah.
So I remember at the time, a lot of speculation about, well, now he's humbled, will the Murdoch empire change? Not so fast. Because fast forward, I suppose, to the 2020 election. And in America, the presidential election, and Trump's election denial, and Fox News joins in this narrative, but with the problem that its own prediction electoral forecast team the night of the election had accurately predicted that Biden was winning. And so suddenly they faced this problem, which was they're reporting accurately, but their viewers are turning over to more MAGA-ish, more Trumpite channels like Newsmax. And so they then followed this extraordinary kind of spectacle, which became public due to a law case earlier this year, when everyone at Fox knew that Trump's claim that the election had been stolen was nonsense. And yet the key presenters and the programs were giving airtime to Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, people who are now named in many of the Trump indictments, spouting nonsense, knowingly so. And they were sued by Dominion, one of the electoral software companies involved in this, earlier this year, and it was settled out of court for many hundreds of millions.
Well, for something like $750 million. $787.5 million
in April.
And it was reported that Murdoch thought he'd get away with $50 million. And it cost him $750 million.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Dominion had lost business on the back of it.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about that is that and I remember writing about it at the time, before the settlement, was that Lachlan was as deeply involved in the deception as his father, Rupert, if not more so. You know, he was running Fox, and he was one of the guys saying, we need to watch out, you know, we're losing viewers, what do we do to, in terms of our coverage of this story, to win them back? So actually, the humility, as you said earlier, yeah, is entirely on the surface. I mean, yeah, they paid off Dominion, yeah, and in spite of everything that was revealed about Lachlan, he is now inheriting the Empire.
And so, I mean, I wonder what kind of emperor will Lachlan turn out to be? Because it's a very different empire than the one it was.
Yes,
you know, in its pomp. Much reduced. And also Lachlan, by all accounts, I think, doesn't care that much about newspapers. Isn't a newspaper native like, you know, like his dad.
No, it's very interesting because I learned earlier this week that his father, Rupert, has put in a bid for the whole Telegraph Group. Now, it's been widely reported that they want The Spectator, which they'd like to turn into a global magazine, and I think there have been talks between The Spectator and the Murdoch Empire. But there'll be a tension here, because, as you say, Lachlan, I think, regards most print as ridiculously analogue and old-fashioned and 20th century. He might want to keep the Wall Street Journal or the New York Post, who knows, but I'd be surprised if his instinct is to keep the British titles. And yet, here is his father, age 92, bidding for another financially troubled newspaper group.
Is it at all feasible that Rupert would run the Telegraph, the Sunday Telegraph, and the Spectator
I think we're at the bone here, which is like, what does emeritus mean, yes, right? I mean, there's a famous story about...
he's now going to be chairman emeritus,
yes,
is it?
Yeah, yeah. There's a famous story about Murdoch sacking one of his editors, I can't remember who it was, and this guy taking the title editor emeritus, and the sacked editor asking what that meant. Yeah. And Murdoch replied, well, the E stands for exit, and the emeritus is because you bloody deserve it, right? So, but I don't think he'll be that kind of emeritus. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine him not, to some extent, after all these decades, being a backseat driver.
Well, he also owns a big chunk of
that. And so, will he be? I mean, again, the succession.
Is he on the board? I mean, do we?
We don't know yet. Yeah. But I mean, I can't imagine he's stepping back entirely.
No.
And again, we get into succession territory, because the one thing you can be sure of the kind of mindset and mentality of these kind of media moguls is that they believe they're immortal.
Yeah.
And they certainly don't hand over power willingly.
Even at 92.
Yeah. I mean, apparently he has a new girlfriend and, yeah, you know...
He must be on, like, getting bloody blood transfusions or something 24/7.
I mean, I can see that if you're thinking about the business,
yeah,
and you're 92, you might think that this is probably a smart move. But I can also imagine that after he's been on a nice holiday,
yeah,
he'll come back and think, hang on a minute, you know, I didn't say that was okay.
I saved his life once, do you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's true. It is true. It's a bit of a bombshell. Maybe we should come back
after a bit. No, tell me now.
It was in Abu Dhabi at the Abu Dhabi Media Forum, right? And I went with Richard Wallace, who was the editor of The Mirror at the time. The two of us went. And we were having this great time and this marvellous... It was that same hotel where the Formula One track goes underneath it, right? So amazing venue. And the Murdochs are there. And Rupert, the day before, had given this speech where it became apparent he had the flu or something like that. And he just didn't look well. And he was rambling through this terrible speech about the sands of time will come to, you know, and all of this. And lost his place a couple of times and just stopped. And like all totally powerful men, just stopped, you know, and thought, no problem, I'll just find my place.
Yeah.
But everyone else thought, my God, he's dying.
Yeah,
you know, and was, people were starting
this
to
is it.
Get their cameras out, thought he's having a heart
it's
attack
happening.
Or something like this. Anyway, he didn't. He got through the speech. And then the night after, there was a party at this rooftop terrace. And Richard was sat next to me and said, oh, I'm just going to go to the loo. And as Richard walked off to the loo, I see Murdoch walking straight past him. Richard doesn't clock him. and he's walking straight towards me. And I think, well, I might as well introduce myself to this Titan. And as I stood up to greet Rupert Murdoch, there was like a 2-inch step on the decking, and he tripped over and fell into my arms, and I caught him, right? And I caught Murdoch. He would have definitely clattered forward onto a coffee table with major repercussions for share prices across the world. But anyway, I caught him, propped him up, and he went, "Thanks very much, Sam." And I said, "Rupert, Matt Kelly from the Daily Mirror," said, "Nice to meet you." And then just trotted off past
me. The ironies multiply. He went off to be responsible for Brexit, without which we wouldn't be sitting here. So in a way, happy thing. It's a happy
Christopher
thing.
Christopher Nolan would put that right at the end of the movie, wouldn't he?
Yes, that would be the kind of...
Where everything came clear.
That's why Brexit happened.
That was the hinge of history.
That's why the two mats happened. That's why the New European is the fastest growing paper in Europe,
and,
you know.
And the UK is fucked as an economy.
And why we are living in a bin fire of a nation.
It was that 2-inch decking
If you
step.
Hadn't been there with your Jedi reflexes,
imagine. It was involuntary.
He'd now be in a coma, you know. And we'd still be in the EU.
Happy thoughts. Yeah. Damn it. I missed it. I should have just done a quick sidestep.
It's the hand of history, isn't it? It's the hand of history again. But it's an amazing story. And I think we'll be... I'm sure we'll return to it, won't we?
I'm sure we will. Well, that was a bit of a Spike Milligan about Hitler, wasn't it?
My part in his survival.
Thank you for that, Matt. Fascinating. And we'll come back after the break with more media news.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, Matt, we're going to go on to another controversial media figure that has dominated the news this week, and that's Mr. Russell Brand.
Yes, I mean, there was a lot of buzz on the Friday after we recorded our last episode about this coming, the Dispatches documentary in the Sunday Times investigation. Lots of speculation about who it was, and it turned out to be Russell Brand, and it's been, you know, leading the news pretty much ever since.
You wrote a great piece in the New European this week.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, the first thing to say is the story is really about the women who had the courage to come forward, and particularly the kind of proper, old-fashioned, really hardcore reporting of Rosamund Irwin at the Sunday Times and her team that led them to select four watertight cases that they knew that they could, you know, if push came to shove, could get into court and win. out of many, apparently, about Russell Brand, and it involves, as if I think everyone knows by now, you know, allegations of rape and sexual assault. He denies all these categorically, one has to say, but the
grim stuff, yeah.
The reporters are very confident.
Yeah. It should be noted, there has been no suggestion that he's going to sue anybody for defamation.
Not at all.
Yeah. Which would be my first instinct if someone accused me of
rape. You would
have
thought that, yeah. That would be the first thing, yeah. but it hasn't been. So, I mean, my thoughts, first of all, was, the incredible courage of the women coming forward and the brilliance of the reporting involved. And it's good. It's nice when journalism has a good day like that.
And it's probably worth making a point, just a throwback to our discussion about Murdoch, is that in a world where there aren't people like Murdoch who, despite all his faults, does invest in journalism, these investigations can't happen. And
not at all.
They won't happen. So
I mean, it took them 4 years,
yeah.
This.
Yeah.
That's what people are sort of playing with when they say, it doesn't really matter. You can do this on the back of an envelope. No, you can't. If you want investigations of this caliber, it takes a long time and a lot of money. But my other thought about this was that I was really annoyed by the suggestion that there has been for a long time, actually, that people like Russell Brand are rebels and outsiders and guerrillas, because, as I think has now become very widely known, he has been for some time a kind of keyboard warrior, and a vodcaster, and he has drifted from the left to not quite the alt-right, but a kind of conspiracy theorist mentality. And one does wonder, he's got 28 million followers or something like that across all the platforms, whether he was and I wrote this in the piece, he was kind of building a digital stockade around himself for this moment, which he knew would come sooner or later. Because what's interesting is that the defense of him, and there have been a lot of people defending him, a horrible list of people, Andrew Tate, Elon Musk, Tucker Carlson, Alex Jones, when you've got friends like that who needs enemies, but also a lot of his followers saying, this is the Matrix, this is the Illuminati, this is what you expect with Russell Gold, was getting too close to the truth.
Also, weirdly, loads of women,
yes.
Journalists that, Bev Turner, Alison Pearson.
It's very surprising, isn't it?
Really, really weird. That's your instinct to go.
It shows is that, in fact, we probably need a new term other than conspiracy theory. Because I think, when we were growing up, conspiracy theories was kind of tinfoil hat, Roswell, Yetis, Loch Ness Monster. It was a kind of fringe activity, and it was funny,
Yeah.
But conspiracy theories have now entered the mainstream. So as you say, you've got people who are not, sitting in a basement in somewhere in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
These are people on big media organizations who are, to some extent, I mean, in the Alison Pearson tweet, she referred to they with a capital T,
yeah.
Which is a classic conspiracy theory trope. I don't know who they are.
Neither does she, by the way.
And neither does she. Yeah. And it's, but it's, as you say,
it's the suggestion.
It's the suggestion. Yeah. And I think that we have to, in all of our political analysis now, kind of price in the whole idea of conspiracy theories as being mainstream, not fringe.
Mm.
You look at Trump, the extent to which he is now ahead. The polls this week say he's ahead of Biden. The guy is facing 91 criminal charges, every one of which is convincing his hardcore MAGA supporters that he's even better than they thought he was.
Yeah.
And it's a really, the dynamics of politics and media are now have changed so much. And so, to roll back a bit, the Meta looking into a 2003 allegation of rape in Soho, again, Brand denies this categorically. So there is a real world where, he is now under criminal investigation, yeah, yeah, by the cops. But yeah, but it is, one needs to be permanently vigilant now, because, yeah, as you say, that there's a, it's surprising the kind of people who are running to his defence.
So,
not just suspending judgment, yeah, but running, yeah, to his defence.
Some of the things that struck me weird about this story. One, there's a lot of people trying to shut stuff down by saying, you know, he's innocent until proven guilty.
And, which is true in a criminal case,
that's absolutely true. Yeah. He is innocent. But that doesn't mean that a reasonable person shouldn't read a dossier compiled by credible journalists, done in credible news platforms, in incredible detail, and come to the conclusion that he is a vile individual. And you know, that's absolutely reasonable.
Well, I mean, it's investigations like this that in the end did for Boris Johnson, because, you know, had it not been for Pippa Crera and ITV, Partygate would never have come to light. And, you know, he was in fact, as was Rishi Sunak, handed a penalty.
But it's almost as though there's a sort of narrative developing, which is that nothing is true until it's been proven true in a court of law.
And
that's,
even
that's
then,
bullshit.
You know? And even then, can you imagine, I mean, again, emphasising that he denies all charges, but let's say that he is charged and let's say that he is convicted. We know that the Matrix will then be said by his supporters just to have absorbed the judicial system and the jury system, and the jury was tampered with. And there's a kind of readiness to move the goalposts, to shift the narrative endlessly to acquit the person you're supporting, which is defies all rationality. But this is the post-truth world we're living in. And I think, you know, Russell Brand, never been a fan of his, but it does... It has made me think a lot about how some decades are radically more different from what follows than others. So the 90s and the noughties were not very different. But boy, the 2020s are different to the period we're talking about here,
well,
the period of lad culture. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, we describe it as lad culture, and you have a sort of vision of your head of, like, you know, pastry girls and, you know, Loaded magazine and all of this business. But when you look at what lad culture actually meant, it's, some of it's horrific.
Well,
you
was know, Danny Dyer saying sometimes a woman needs a good slap.
Chris Moyles saying, I'd like to lead, what's her name, Charlotte Church. At the age of 16.
Yes.
I'd like to lead her through the forests of her sexuality or whatever it was. Right, on Radio 1, right? Yeah. It's Chris Evans, you know, like, so, you know, there's something weird about that which wouldn't stand up to scrutiny today. Chris Evans, aged 35 or 36, buying Billy Piper a Ferrari the day after he met her and saying, I'm going to marry you. Her, she was aged 17 or 18.
Which she did.
And she did.
Yeah.
Now, you know, an FHM lauding... you know, or the son, rather, lauding him as Shagger of the Year.
Shagger of the Year, several times.
There were still naked, topless women on the page three of the Sun up until 10 years ago, basically, I think.
And it was all, I remember, I mean, because the Dispatches programme, I think, brilliantly interspliced some of his stand-up material from that
era. God, that wasn't that, the mascara stuff?
Yes, and what you realised was that, like Saville, he was basically saying exactly what he was alleged to have been doing in private. And it was all, I remember vividly, because it was all sort of defended under this veil of, oh, it's just irony. Now, I love irony, and life without irony is life unlived. However, I remember David Foster Wallace writing a brilliant essay about the tyranny of irony and how if you are just ironic, nothing means anything. And there was a bit of that, I think.
It's hollowed out. You've hollowed yourself out. Yeah.
Because I remember, I mean, one of the things that he Russell Brand, was indisputably guilty of was the horrible episode, I think it was in 2008, where he had had an affair with Andrew Sachs's granddaughter.
Georgina Bailey or
something. That's right. Yeah. And he, Russell Brand, and Jonathan Ross, guesting with him on his Radio 2 show, left a series of horrific messages on Andrew Sachs's answer phone.
Yeah.
And indeed, as was reported widely this week, Georgina Bailey, who was kind of invisible in this whole thing, has suffered enormous mental health issues and so on.
And so the saddest thing about it is she blamed herself.
Yeah, she blamed herself. But I remember by coincidence, meeting Andrew Sachs about not long after the whole thing had happened. Russell Brand had been sacked. He'd gone off to Hollywood to make movies. The controller of Radio 2 had been sacked, but only after a while. And, you know, the conversation turned naturally to what had just happened to him. And he was immensely sad about what had happened. And
he didn't speak to his granddaughter for 8 years or something like that.
A long time. And the saddest thing was, he said, I remember vividly, why did Russell Brand think he could get away with that? And that was the question. And the question, of course, was because it was a time when he was being given a huge amount of rope by his media handlers, by the BBC and Channel 4, you know, and other organisations. And I think the investigations into the internal investigations of the BBC at Channel 4 will not make for pretty reading.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we know, for example, it's alleged that the 16-year-old who's using the pseudonym Alice and was on Woman's Hour with an actor's voice was allegedly taken to, he was 31 when they were having an affair, and was taken to his house or flat in a BBC car when she was 16.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary.
That was the most touching thing, I think, about the whole thing, was when the taxi driver turned to the girl, 60, and said, "Look,
don't go in there.
Please, I've got a daughter your age. Don't do it."
And, you know, he allegedly sexually assaulted her quite seriously. And it is very, very hard to hear, read, watch these allegations. But we need to, because they remind you of how relatively recently the culture was radically different.
But this, I think this is, okay, so, I mean, there's a lot to be really depressed about in this story.
Yeah.
But also, you can reflect how far we've come in 10, 15 years as a society,
yes,
that this stuff is now just intolerable.
Yeah,
and I'd like to raise a point which I think should be raised because one, I think she's really brilliant. I'm talking about Marina Hyde, the Guardian columnist. And I love her to bits. I think she's just a fantastic force in journalism. But she wrote a piece this week about how much we've changed and how much she felt personally guilty about the way that she had treated Georgina Bailey. And I went back and I found the column that she was referring to about her. And it's horrific. It's horrific. You know, I mean, not only was she unkind to Georgina Bailey, but she basically said, "Shut up and get over it," literally, and called her all sorts of vile names within that piece. And like I say, Marina's one of the most decent people I've come across.
That's exactly what I was thinking when you were saying
this. We're wrapped up in a culture.
That's the problem, you know, is that, you know, in cultures that were like that,
yeah,
and maybe to some extent are more than we are ready to admit, still, a person as decent as Marina Hyde can write that.
Yeah.
And, you know, fair play to her for writing a piece, putting her hands up in the air. But it did illustrate.
If I'm being honest, I think I would have been a bit more open about what I had written in the first place, because she sort of glided around it in the piece. And a better piece would have been to say, "This is what I said at the time, and I can't believe I wrote it."
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it is extraordinary, and it just illustrates the difference between, you know, not a very long period of time, actually.
Well, look, and also, you know, none of us should be sanctimonious about this, because if you've been around in journalism as long as we both have, you've come across stories where you've made judgments that you look back on now 10 years, 20 years later, and you think, Jesus Christ, what were we thinking of?
No, absolutely. I mean, without question. And, you know, it's doing a kind of self-audit forced by that sort of investigation is a very healthy practice.
I think it is. And I think we should all think twice before throwing too many stones, because if all it becomes is mudslinging, as it became between Hadley Freeman and Owen Jones, where there was a competition about who had sucked up to Russell Brand most, or, you know, just...
What matters...
Then it's just polarised nonsense.
The truth is that the only thing that matters, really, is that the women who've had the courage to come forward get the justice they deserve. And I hope they do.
Yeah, I'd build on that. I don't think it's the only thing that matters. I think...
Well, it's the main thing that matters.
That is definitely the main priority.
Number one.
But I think the ripple effect from that we all that the world is just a bit more decent, without wanting to sound too kind of Disney, the world is just a little bit better.
Yes.
Because we're all thinking about this shit is also a good result.
It forces reflection, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And you can see that, I mean, Russell Brand did a preemptive video night before on his YouTube channel, denying everything preemptively without specifying what he was denying. And you could see from his manner that he was fairly confident, or at least acting as if he was fairly confident, that he's going to get away with it. And I don't think he is, actually. That's my one bet on this.
I've got a slightly different take on your theory about him consciously building this stockade, as you called it. I don't think he's that smart. I just think that he's an enormous narcissist, and he'd run out of mainstream platforms.
That's true.
And he graduated to the only platform he could find, which was social media. And he thrives on narcissism. And so it was almost inevitable he would find somewhere to get this.
I mean, let's put it this
out.
Way. I'm sure he intuited that once you've got the attention of conspiracy theorists, they're a lot more loyal than the more capricious, conventional fandom that he'd cultivated in the noughties and the tens, you know. We shall see. But I mean, this is one to watch. It really is.
Definitely.
Big story.
Okay, so what didn't we have time to talk about this week, Matt?
Well, I'd like to give a shout out to a movie whose premiere I was very lucky to attend last night, which is The Great Escaper, which is a three-hander with Sir Michael Caine, the late Glenda Jackson, sadly died in June, age 87, and John Standing. And it tells a true story of a guy called Bernie Jordan, who in 2014 basically did a runner from his care home in Hove and made his way solo to Normandy for the 70th anniversary of D-Day. And it's just a terrific,
fantastic
movie. And it's kind of deeply emotional without being in the slightest bit sentimental.
Fantastic.
Terrific movie.
Have you ever seen The Straight Story by directed by David Lynch, about an old guy who gets on his lawnmower to go and see his brother?
Terrific movie. No, I think it's out on October the 6th, and I can't recommend
it
highly enough.
Fantastic. I'd like to mention, I live in Highbury in Arsenal, and I found myself bizarrely starstruck because... And I'm pretty good around famous people, and I work on the basis that they've got to be somewhere,
right?
And it just happens.
Yes, they can't be. They don't live in the ether.
They're all
there.
Yeah. So anyway, but I was sort of passing where Burberry were having their fashion show on Highbury Fields, and there was this congregation of kids all screaming and the paparazzi and lights going off. And so curiosity overtook me, and I came by and I stood and watched lots of Koreans and Japanese fashion influencers, I assume, and K-pop stars and all of this. But then Kano arrived.
Oh, my lordy.
Otherwise known as Sully from Top Boy.
Yes.
Looking absolutely resplendent in a sort of camouflage tracksuit. And Kano did his thing on the sort of walkway in. And I just found myself in, you know, I had no idea how much I thought of him. But a brilliant star.
At your recommendation, I have started watching it.
Have you? Yeah.
And spot on.
It's great.
It's tremendous.
People are going to think this is sponsored by Netflix, but it's not. But it is. Top Boy.
We're very happy to be sponsored by Netflix. If you're out there, Netflix, we are.
Or Burberry.
Or Burberry. Or anyone, really. But should we also quickly talk about Keir Starmer?
Yes.
And the EU. Because interesting week. I mean, we talked a lot on the podcast about Keir Starmer and the EU, but... he seems to have... I don't think it's a policy change, but there's a little more confidence in his approach to all this, which is he was in Ottawa, I think, Montreal, and he gave an interview to the FT in which he said that when our trade and cooperation agreement with the EU comes up for renewal in 2025-26, he's going to, you know, really try and make it more of a proper partnership with the EU. And just something in the language made me very cautiously optimistic.
Yeah.
However, and I know what you're going to say is...
Then
France and Germany suggest a new system of tiered system of membership of the EU, including associate membership, which is clearly designed to be for the UK.
Yeah.
And Labour ran a mile.
To say no chance, yeah.
Yeah.
And so the thing that pisses me off about Keir Starmer's approach to all of this is I honestly don't know what he believes. And I'm honestly beginning, I don't want to sound like I hate every politician. I don't, and I certainly don't hate Keir Starmer. But I do think he has got a transparency issue where I don't think he is prepared to tell people what they don't want to hear. And I think he also has a track record for pledging things and making announcements and then dropping them when it becomes inconvenient. You know, the two-child cap on benefits, he pledged that he would drop that and then he's reversed that. Tuition fees, he's backed out on that.
£28 billion pounds a year on climate change.
Backed out on that. Taxing the top 5% more, backed out on that. And nationalisation as well, or what they called common ownership, kind of bit of lawyerly language he introduced around that. And when it comes to Brexit, I think this thing he said to the FT about wanting to renegotiate the deal, well, you know, he's got to get, it takes two to tango, and I'm not sure there's any appetite at the European Union for a serious material renegotiation. They see this point as about finessing stuff, not as let's rip it up and start again. So I also believe that until the European Union are confident that both main parties in the UK have got a clear view on what our relationship with Europe should be, they're not really that interested in our psychodrama anymore.
So for the listeners of the Two Mats, I thought, public service, I'd just call someone who I knew knows Keir very well.
Okay.
Yesterday, Wednesday.
Is it Keir?
I'm not prepared to disclose my sources.
Oh, my God.
And I said, what's going on? And I've got my notes here, which is, so I said, you know, because on the back of Gina Miller's excellent cover piece in the New European this week, I thought, come on then. I said, what is his policy on rejoining? Keir does not expect the UK to rejoin the EU during his time as Prime Minister. Okay?
Okay.
Number one. So I thought, okay, that's a bit wiggle room. So I said, does he expect to apply for membership? Answer: he does not expect that to happen on his watch either, right?
Right.
So my final try, what about rejoining the single market? Quote, you are aware of Labour's policy on that,
which is not in the government.
That was the only bit of non-denial, right?
Yeah.
So I just leave that on the table for people to consider.
Well, I think we are caught in a gulf between actuality and what is being said, and that is largely to keep people on side. And I get that he's talking to two constituencies and he needs their votes, but at least one of those constituencies is going to be deeply pissed off come a Labour government. So thanks for listening, folks. We will be rolling out, this is big news, a second weekly question and answer episode in a couple of weeks. So get your questions in, please, and thank you, by the way, to all those who have already emailed, but get your questions in too. Two Mats, that's the number 2, MATTS, at tnepublishing.co.uk. Two Mats at tnepublishing.co.uk. TNE like the New European. Listeners to the Two Mats podcast can become subscribers to the New European, and why wouldn't you want to, and get a free copy of Rory Stewart's brand new book, Politics on the Edge, which is the number 1 bestseller.
It is.
So you can get that for free.
What a bargain.
What a bargain. And the New European from just £1 a week. My God.
Another bargain.
Honestly. Head to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. And there's a link in the show notes. And you can get all of the digital at New European for £1 a week. Or if you want the newspaper delivered to your door every single week, what joy. That's just another £1 a week as well. Thank you as ever to the third Matt, producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.